Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today we have a very interesting guest. His name is Victor Yako, and he's going to be sharing everything about psychology in UI UX design. He just wrote his new book called Design for the Mind, which is going out soon, and we're going to be asking him all different questions about psychology. So, hi, Victor.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me today.
We are thrilled to have you in here.
I'm glad to hear that.
Tell us your story, how you got started with psychology and UX, and how that blends together in your career.
Sure. So, it was sort of like luck in a lot of ways that I got involved in the UX piece, at least. My background has always been in psychology or working with people and looking at their behaviors. And I went to graduate school at Ohio State, and I looked at how people were interacting in places like zoos and science centers with the exhibit spaces, and how they were learning, and how the people who created those exhibits could try to frame communication and make the experiences accomplish their goals. So a lot of times when a zoo or a science center has an exhibit area, they don't just want people to come with their families and have a good time. They want them to leave with a message. Like if it's a zoo, conservation is a very important message. And they want people to leave thinking, oh, I want to learn more information about how I can reduce my impact on the environment, or think a little bit more about what my purchases are doing to animal habitat on another continent. And so those are really hard messages to convey to people in a way that's meaningful. And so there's a lot of research on communication and psychology in those settings. And that's what I was doing for quite a few years. And I got my PhD studying in that area. And then I was looking for something different. And I had a friend who was working in the Philadelphia area. And I told her that I was thinking about relocating. She was a friend and she was also a former colleague. So she knew about the work that I was doing and the experiences I had. And she said, hey, there's this great design firm that's looking for a researcher. And I was like, okay, well, I don't really know what that is, but I'll throw my hat in for the position. And what really it turned out to be a great opportunity for me, and I felt like what I was bringing, my background experiences, was really relevant, which was how to work with people, how to create interviews, how to create surveys, how to observe people and their behaviors in natural settings and try to turn that into design recommendations. And so in the past, it had been design recommendations for zoo exhibits or communication around scientific topics. And so just translating that into design recommendations around user interface really made sense. And that's when I started writing about psychology as well, which is when I saw that all of the things I had learned about psychology for spaces like zoos and science centers, all of those topics were still applicable in a digital setting. And so that was where I was able to start contributing, was writing about, okay, well, how would I apply this psychological principle or this topic in a digital design scenario? And that pretty much brings you up to where I'm at today. Eventually, I published a few articles with A List Apart and Smashing Magazine, and I realized I had enough in my head to make a book, and I shopped my proposal around and found a home at Manning Publications, and now the book should be out any day now, Design for the Mind.
That sounds very exciting. So is it your first book?
It is my first book. I like to say that I always thought I would write a book. I never thought I would write a book about psychology and design. That's what ended up happening, and I'm really pleased with it, and hopefully there will be more. Maybe it'll be on other principles of psychology, or maybe I'll expand and look at some of the research components or something else. But I had a good time writing it, and I still do write articles and things like that, so I'm not in full-blown, like, relax mode because I finished the book or anything.
It's called a launch campaign. It's not relax mode. Come on.
That's right. No, what do you mean? Now I have to make people try to be interested in purchasing the thing? Aw, I thought my job was done.
Sure. So could you tell us a little bit more, what kind of ideas are you promoting in the book? I imagine you have like a few core concepts that you advocate for. So we're going to walk through essentials in psychology a little later. Okay. But what founding pillars is your book on?
All right. So really what I focus on in the subtitle of the book is 7 psychological principles of persuasive design. And so I'm pulling in principles from what's known as persuasion and influence in psychology. And it really is around getting people to understand why they should behave or act in certain ways. And so I often hear people say that persuasion comes across as trickery or like a very dirty word. You know, you're persuading people to do something, you're trying to sell them a used car that doesn't really work or something that's not necessarily on the up and up. Also, people think about things like dark patterns being part of persuasion. And what I say is not from an academic perspective, from a psychological perspective, that's not true to the definition of persuasion. Lying or coercion, forcing someone to do something that they don't want to do, like if you create a dark pattern where people have to opt into something in order to proceed, that's not persuasion. Persuasion is presenting information in a way that shows somebody why they should want to do something. And in that sense, a usable experience is persuasive. It makes people want to use it more versus a completely dysfunctional experience that they have to overthink and compensate for by doing a lot of extra work. That's leaving persuasion out of the question or out of the scenario. So if you aren't persuasive, then it's possibly because you're not trying to effectively address your users' needs. And so what I've tried to do through the book is present specific concepts around different psychological principles that relate to persuasion, and also teach people how to talk about it, how to talk about your design in a way that says, oh, I tapped into these psychological principles, but not in a way that's going to turn off the whole room and be like, oh, this guy or this girl wants to talk about nothing but psychology and theory, and now I'm going to fall asleep, because I understand that those aren't necessarily words that convey a lot of excitement. But if you're sitting in front of a client or if you're sitting in a meeting with your fellow design peers and you're talking about why your design works and you can explain it from a psychological perspective, oh, hey, these features tap into this part of user psychology, or at least they're meant to, that gets people thinking, oh, you really know what you're doing. You really understand your users. And if you pair that with actual data that you collect from your users, your design should be really strong.
This is really, really, really important, because sometimes in smaller businesses, you don't have that much data to rely on. And, you know, justifying your design decision is a huge, important topic for all designers out there. I once wrote a blog post about that you can even kind of invent your own reasoning and your own, you know, ideas and concepts to prove your point. But psychology here is the perfect way to do that. So, where would you, like, what stage of design projects would you think psychology would be applicable? So one is definitely design reasoning. Something else?
So I feel like that it should be considered from the start of thinking about why your product should even exist. So what underlying psychological needs exist, or if you're going to be addressing users' needs, what underlying psychological principles can you tap into? So if you're creating a social experience, what experiences or what psychological principles that talk about how people engage in social experiences should you think about ahead of time? Because really, in the end, I completely agree with what you said about you don't always have the luxury of data. And a lot of times when I speak about the psychological principles, I tell people, in the absence of data, people often make things up. They're just completely going to make something up that suits what they feel like should be right. Well, a theory of psychology that's been at least tested and studied for a while is something that's been out in the wild and that researchers have done a fair amount of work trying to prove it wrong. That's sort of the point of research, is to say this theory doesn't work in these scenarios. And so the longer a theory has been around and the more it's stood up to testing, the more likely it is to give you something useful. But all that is to say, I think that throughout the entire design process, if you can identify it up front, then you can say, okay, I'm going to use social identity theory. That's a specific theory that I talk about. I'm going to use that, and there's two key components to that. And I'm going to talk about, from beginning to end, how my product addresses these two key components that help people develop their social identities. And I'm going to stay true to that as a framework. Then I can explain why my design works. And if your design doesn't work, you can throw that theory away and try to pull in something else. Or you can also say, well, look, you know, I thought we were doing a really good job allowing people to engage in social comparison, but it turns out that's not what they're doing. How can we tinker with that to make that work in a better way? Because a lot of this is still fairly new, both from a psychological perspective. Psychology isn't the oldest field in the world. It hasn't been around for thousands of years or hundreds of years even. And then when you talk about digital user interfaces, that's, you know, within the last few decades. Yeah. And so we're still learning. I completely advocate a pick and choose to sort of a la carte way of putting together psychological principles with your design to make it work for you. I wouldn't want people to feel constrained by having to account for psychology. I think there's a good way of doing it and feeling sort of liberated.
So we couldn't do well without, you know, reciting those seven principles that you're advocating for in your book. Seven, am I right?
Yes, seven psychological principles.
But seven psychological principles of persuasive design. Sounds so amazing to me. Please walk us through.
All right. You want them in alphabetical order? I'm just kidding. I can't do that. So, well, let me give you just a little background then, if you're going to ask me to do that, is that these by no means are the only seven principles that I think people could or should use. However, they're ones that were familiar with me and that were well tested. They've been around for a while, and I feel like I can do a good job explaining how they can be accounted for in digital design, which is what my day job is, explaining how my research findings can be accounted for. And so, you know, ultimately, it's up to somebody to decide, do I want to use this or not? You don't need to use all seven of them. You can pick and choose pieces. So in the order, at least, that they appear in the book, I can give them to you, and I'll give you just a little insight into each one. But the book starts off with a section about behavior and what creates behavior. And that's sort of the precursor to the persuasion piece, is thinking about, why do people even act the way they do? What causes people to wake up in the morning and decide what to wear, what job they go to, whether or not to buy a new television? And so the first principle that I talk about is called planned behavior, and it's designing things that people intend to do. So thinking about something that maybe is a large purchase where somebody's going to take their time and make that decision, how do we get people to move towards that decision, or another large decision, whether or not they use your product to accomplish their task, whether they look information up using your product, whatever your product is meant to do, somebody has to make a decision, a planned decision. They're going to do that often. And so I talk about how you can address that through behavior beliefs and through social norms, which is showing people how other people that they feel very alike use a product, and control, which is a big issue in psychology, showing people, or at least giving people the perception that they're in control of the outcome of their decision. So, you know, an example would be if somebody is using your site to find information, do they feel like they're in control of the outcome, that they're going to enter information or they're going to enter a search query and the information that's going to be displayed is correct, is relevant, is good information that comes from a reliable source? That makes them feel like they're in control of the outcome of getting good information, versus having an experience where people don't know where the information is coming from, or your search results aren't relevant to the search terms that they entered. That can make people feel like they have no control over the outcome of making the decision to use your product. So that's one example from that chapter. And then, so not every decision we make is really well thought out. So the next chapter starts to talk about what's called in decision-making circles, it's called risky decisions. Decisions that don't have, either don't have certain outcomes or people don't have all the information available to them when they make them. And one specific concept that I talk about in that chapter is a concept of heuristics, or mental shortcuts that people make on a regular basis, probably dozens if not hundreds a day, because you're presented with so many opportunities to do things throughout a day that if you gave it all deep thought, you'd never be able to function at a high level. So you wake up in the morning and you probably eat the first thing that comes to mind as what's a good idea for breakfast that day. And that's called actually the availability heuristic. It's what comes to mind first, what's available in your mind based on either your experiences or some type of information that you've encountered in the past that tells you, oh, cereal is a quick and easy breakfast, so that's what I'm going to do. And so I identify in the book a number of heuristics that researchers have studied and how we can apply those to our design. Another example is something called like the scarcity heuristic, where you make people feel like there's a limited quantity or they have an exclusive opportunity to have access to something, and that makes them more likely to make a decision sooner rather than later if they're considering either making a purchase or using your product for whatever its purpose is. So telling people like, oh, you know, there's a limited quantity of downloads for this product at a certain price, that's more likely to make people say, okay, that's what I want, I'm going to do it now versus waiting for later. And so those are called risky decisions. Then another chapter deals with, are you familiar, Jane, with B.J. Fogg's work and his model of persuasion?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
My shame.
Oh, no. Maybe I just made that name up completely. No, I'm kidding.
Right,
B.J.
Right.
Fogg, he is a researcher and a professor out of Stanford, and he has been around for the last 20 years or so working on what he calls persuasive technology and thinking about how we use technology to change people's behaviors. And so he has what he calls Fogg's model of persuasion or Fogg's behavioral model. I would name a model after myself if I created it as well. So there would be Yako's model of something. But anyway, Fogg came along first. And in the chapter where I talk about his model, it's about when do you present somebody, a user, with the opportunity to do something? So really, when do you present that call to action? And it's being purposeful about when you do that. And Fogg's basic premise is that two things have to be in place before you give somebody a call to action, and that's motivation and ability. So somebody needs to be motivated. They need to understand why they should do something. You don't want to ask them to do something before they understand why, right? That makes pretty good sense. And then they need to have the ability, and that really means, can they engage in this task? So maybe an easy example would be purchasing something. Let's say somebody really, really wants to purchase a brand new, nice car. They're super motivated, but they don't have the money, so they don't have the ability. If you present somebody with the call to action, buy this car, they can't, because they're, even though they're super motivated, their ability hasn't reached a high enough state. Now, let's say you were able to say to somebody who was very motivated by the car, oh, you can take out this loan and it will allow you to buy the car. Would you like to apply for the loan? That is increasing their ability in a way that should align it with their motivation, and then you present the call to action. Okay, you're motivated, and now you have the ability, you can apply for a loan. Now, the call to action, would you like to buy this car? Or, you know, it doesn't have to be a purchase, but just learn more about this concept. You can present somebody with the reason why they should learn it. You can present them with the information in an easy-to-digest way, and then you can say, okay, now learn about it, or take action on this topic. So it's really thinking about when do you present people with what he calls the trigger, or the opportunity to do something, which is after someone's got a high enough level of motivation and ability. And he also talks about you can compensate. So if somebody has low motivation but really easy ability, think of something like a retweet. You might not be super duper motivated to retweet something, but it's so easy to retweet something. If your really close friend tweets something and you want to support them, you might just click retweet, and your motivation might have been super low, but it was so easy to do it, you did it. And so that compensates for low motivation, high ability. And so thinking about that, then go ahead.
I'm thinking, so this is definitely applicable to conversion rate optimization.
Absolutely.
Which is, you know, optimizing websites for people to take action, which I know takes a tons of effort. But how would you find that applicable inside actual, you know, web app internals, let's say, or mobile app internals?
Sure. So, like, if somebody's in the process of engaging in a workflow, let's say that you're asking them for information that they should be inputting, like whatever, if it's an application that's meant to track data around some specific topic, are you making sure that they understand when and why they should be inputting the data, and then actually making an interface that allows them to easily, so increasing their ability by creating an interface that allows them to understand how to enter the data in an error-free way, and also maybe something like inline validation of what people are entering, so that if an error is made, you've increased their ability to catch that error by not letting them move on through the workflow and then presenting at the end, oh, you made an error 10 fields ago, you're going to have to go back and correct that. And so hopefully also by creating a nicer interface, you would increase people's motivation to use something. So
no, that's too easy of an explanation, right?
Well, it would be nice. It would at least be a nice to have for a lot of people. But, you know, coming into work and thinking about staring at a dark screen with squiggly white lines on it versus something that's nicely laid out and the fields exist in a nice, you know, full of white space and the ability to easily identify where information goes, that's definitely going to increase somebody's motivation around wanting to use something, you'd hope.
Absolutely. So going back to the principles that you were recalling.
Okay, sure. And so then the next part of the book, I dive into the persuasion piece really deep. And the first thing I look at is influencing people. And there's Robert Cialdini. He's a pretty famous, or very famous, depending on who you ask, researcher on influence, and he didn't look at it from a digital perspective. He looked at it from sort of a salesperson's perspective, and how do you get people to do things? And so from his work, we get things like reciprocity, which is people tend to want to do something for others who have done something for them. So a really easy example on that is giving away free content. When you give away free content to a potential user, that makes them potentially feel like, oh, now they owe you something. You've done them something. You've given them something. So then you ask them for something in return. For example, you might say, now may I have your email address to add to my user list? And they're more likely, after you've said, here's what I'm giving you, to be like, well, you know, okay, you gave me a free PDF of this useful chapter that's going to help me with my design work. Now I'm more willing to say you can have my email information because I owe you that much in return.
I recall earlier in this conversation you called email opt-in patterns a dark pattern.
Oh no, email so, opt-in if you trap people into no. it.
right, I was going to catch you by your word.
Oh,
I
no.
definitely believe that. That's one of the, you know, marketing pillars in today's world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, well, no, hopefully you're allowing people to opt in. You're not mandating that they opt in. But that's what reciprocity would be allowing people. If you force people, that's absolutely strong-arming them. But another example would be just giving away a discount on your product and then asking people to sign up long-term, or like a free trial. So, hey, you get the first 30 days free, and then you can cancel if you don't like the product. Well, after those 30 days, if someone's been using it, they're going to feel more obligated to stick with your product versus say, oh, well, now I can start a free trial at some place that does something similar, because they're going to feel like they've gotten something from you. And we see this play out in things like giving people birthday gifts. The people who give you gifts on your birthday then you feel a little urge that you should probably acknowledge their birthday when it comes around. It's something that's sort of come along with human evolution, which is we need people to help us out to get through life safely and with everything that we need, because we can't all be completely self-sufficient. So when somebody does something nice for us, our human instincts kick in and say we should do something nice back for them so that we as a species survive. That's what reciprocity is sort of based around. And that's a principle from – or that's a concept from the principle of influence. But then I take it a step further in the next chapter, and I talk about how groups of people influence each other. And one of my favorite things to talk about that I've been presenting on pretty regularly lately is called social identity theory. And I talk about it in the context of like how a product like Facebook taps into social identity theory, or how some other online platforms that promote giving, like Kiva, promotes people giving money for microloans, and they enhance the amount of money people are giving potentially by creating social identities online that people can then give money that makes them feel more like people they're in the same group with. So to be more specific, social identity theory says that people go through life categorizing themselves. So in one situation, you might categorize yourself as a person whose favorite color is black, and your favorite thing to drink is coffee, and your favorite band is a rock and roll band. So after you categorize yourself around all these different things, you start to look at other people and you categorize them as well, and then you compare and you say, am I like this person or am I not like this person? And so I'm going to look for other people whose favorite color is also black and likes heavy metal or rock and roll and his favorite drink is coffee. And through that, we form what's called an in-group. We're a group together. And where social identity theory goes from there is that people start to make decisions based on what other people in their in-group are doing so that they can strengthen their ties. And again, there's like an evolutionary bent to it. Humans survive in groups by working together and making decisions that are aligned with each other, because if you stop making the same decision that the rest of the group does, you're going to wander off from the pack and get eaten by the wolves or something. So, you know, an example of this, though, that I often use in my talk is Mac users versus PC users. Those are two, like, opposite groups, and Mac users have certain characteristics that they categorize themselves around, like being cool and wearing skinny jeans. And then if you think back to the old commercials, PC users, they are very stuffy and they wear suits and they're serious. And so that's a social identity being played out. And what you would think from that is that Mac users are going to make decisions that strengthen their ties with each other. So if the leader of the Mac users group starts to wear a certain brand of shoes, the other Mac group, in-group people, are going to start wearing those shoes. And so how can we create products that don't necessarily create out-groups where people don't like each other, but like Facebook, two completely separate groups can exist on Facebook just fine. So you can have Democrats on one side and Republicans on the other, and they can talk to each other and strengthen their ties, but they don't necessarily have to go to a different platform. They can both be on Facebook. So is there a way of showing people how your product makes them feel like part of a group that they want to belong to and strengthens their ties with these groups? And then going from there, I talk about one of the topics that's really, really fun for me is framing communication. And that's really where I focused my dissertation work, which was how do we say the same thing differently to different people so that it means something to them? So for example, from my dissertation work is I looked at how we talk about complicated environmental issues like water pollution and air pollution and make it meaningful to people based on whether their values are more like egoistical and they care about themselves, or whether they're more likely to care about their friends and family. And looking at, so let's say I wanted you to care about air pollution, and I knew that you were somebody who was you were very much concerned about your kids first and foremost, or your other family members. You were always thinking about the well-being of others. So I might say to you, hey, Jane, do you know that if we have air pollution, it's going to make our children sicker, they're going to have more asthma, they're going to be less likely to have nice, clean forests to visit because everything's going to get sick and die. I probably wouldn't say it in such an extreme way. But, you know, really tapping into the fact that this impacts people that are important to you. That's one way of framing communication. But I might talk to somebody else who I know is completely self-centered, and I might say to them, well, you should care about air pollution because you are going to want to take a luxury vacation someday, and this pristine area off the coast of Hawaii is going to actually be full of smog and horrible, and you're not going to be able to take a wonderful vacation there in 20 years. You should care about air pollution now for the sake of that awesome vacation that you're going to take in 20 years. And then that what I found through my studies is, yes, people do, at least in the short term, tend to perk up and say, okay, now you've made it relevant to me. And so what framing does, it's trying to tap into, and there's thousands of different ways to frame information, and trying to tap into what are the values people hold around your product, why would they want to use it, are there different ways that you should be talking about use of your product. And also I highlight that when I say communication and framing, it's not just words. You frame and you communicate with icons, with messages, with visual design just as much, if not more, than with words. So what is your logo conveying to people? What are the different icons that you're using on your site conveying to people in terms of the values you're tapping into? All right, we're almost through all of them.
That sounds like a great principle, and it's really applicable to all designers. And, you know, we can roughly automate that, I guess, for different environments. For example, in marketing, you don't have to be, you know, targeting 20 groups of people, but you can try and judge by their previous behavior, like clicking on some campaign, what kind of group they belong to, and then send targeted pitches to them instead of sending, you know, generic stuff.
That's
always more applicable. Mm-hmm. So the last few?
All right. So the last one, I believe, that I have left out is what's actually called a model of persuasion. And it's referred to as the elaboration likelihood model. And what it is it says that people are persuaded by information through two routes. Imagine imaginary roads in your brain. Let's just say that. So these researchers suggested that we have two imaginary roads in our brain, and information travels down one or both of these roads based on whether or not people think the information is important to them, the topic is important to them, and then how well the information is presented. And so the first route is called central route processing, and that's where somebody is going to pay really close attention to the details, and they're going to make a decision based on how well the information is presented. So if you think about it from a user experience perspective, they're going to pay really close attention to whether or not your product does what it says it does, whether or not they can understand the workflows. And the way you get people to process their information through the central route is to show them why something is relevant. And so showing people how use of your product is related to a life issue. Let's say you have a tax software. You want to show people tax software is relevant because everyone pays taxes, and if you make errors in filing your taxes, you're more likely to be audited. Being audited is a horrible thing. My software can solve that. But then, okay, you've convinced somebody your software can solve that. If they're truly going through the central route, they're going to scrutinize your product, and that's when you have to come through with a great design and with what's called by researchers a strong argument, a really well-presented argument for why your product works. And in a digital design sense, a strong argument would be a usable experience and something that when people think things are happening, like checking to make sure all of their forms are filled out correctly, that actually is happening, and you're calling out mistakes or you're giving them some type of guarantee or reassurance that the forms have been filled out correctly and submitted to the tax collecting body. So then let's say, though, people aren't convinced. Taxes just aren't relevant to me. It's not that important. Whatever. I'm 18 and, you know, this is my first time filing taxes, so I don't understand necessarily that there's huge ramifications here. That's when people go through what's called the secondary route, and that's when the persuasion that we think about as being sort of salesy comes into play, because people aren't going to scrutinize the information, but they are going to scrutinize things like, who is this message coming from? So let's say your company's name was TurboTax. People would probably default to, oh, that sounds like a tax company. I should use their product, versus a company whose name was like Lazy Tax. Then people are going to think, if they're not truly paying attention to the experience, which let's say Lazy Tax has a better experience, but people processing it through their secondary route are going to be more impressed by the name, or they might be more impressed by a celebrity endorsing a certain product, or they might be impressed by credentials. So saying, you know, we've saved 700 people $600 million versus not having a testimonial like that around your product. And then again, it would come down to visual design and aesthetics. If your product was super functional, but the person using it didn't see the relevancy, and they look at your product and they see something that's just got a horrible UI and they don't understand where to go and they get frustrated really easily, they'll quickly move on. Versus maybe somebody's not interested at all in what you do, but you've made such a wonderful experience and presented them with something that makes sense, everything unfolds the way they expected it to, it's so easy to use, that they use it anyway because it's just so easy to do. That is tapping into persuasion in the truest sense as it's theorized by academics through that model. And then ideally what you would do is some combination of the routes. And when I've written about it, I've used Amazon as an example. Amazon's a pretty easy example for a lot of things. But they make things relevant and they back it up with some of the secondary stuff as well. So they show you things like the product details that allow you to really dig in and understand the product. But then they also have a button that says buy now. So you can skip all that and you don't have to think about it, and you can just see the pretty picture and you can say, well, that's exactly the TV I want. And you see right next to it that it says Prime. So you know you're going to be able to have it shipped to you in 2 days if you're a Prime customer, and you just click it. And that's really taking advantage of the secondary route, which is saying people aren't going to look so closely. They're just going to make this split decision. But you can sort of account for both and then create a really strongly persuasive experience, which I think it would be hard to argue that Amazon isn't persuading people to do what they want them to do on their site.
Absolutely. We are talking about long-form sales copy right here because there is a very common argument of people saying that, you know, who reads the text? But people who are engaged and who are going the first route definitely will be reading the copy, while, you know, the scanners could just jump through testimonials and headlines and be convinced and hit that big green button on the bottom right away.
That is exactly the point. Perfect. Yes.
And, you know, they're from what I know about sales pages, there are different kinds of objections that people need to be, that people need to defy before they proceed with the purchase essay. And different kinds of people have different kinds of objections. So social proof is the way to defy, you know, an objection like, has anyone done that before me? Like, is this person credible? Et cetera, et cetera. And a ton of others. I highly recommend, if you probably have, but if people haven't, the book called Brain Audit by Sean D'Souza.
Okay.
It's pretty awesome in terms of writing long-form sales copy. But yeah, it doesn't go that deep into psychology for sure, but it arrives at the same conclusions.
Excellent.
So now that we know all these principles and we kind of know how to apply them in different situations, I wonder what is your professional approach on actually practicing them? Besides, you know, theorizing and writing books about it, Do you actually consult people on them? How do you come in and how do you apply these principles?
Yeah, so it's something that comes up in discussions, in meetings, and talking about how. So I work for a consultancy. We don't have our own product. We come in and we try to help other people who are either trying to create a product, make a good one, or people who have one that's currently out there, improve on it. And a lot of times I'll be the voice of talking about why some of our design concepts are meant to do the things they do. And I'll use themes that we have identified through our research and tie that into psychological principles to say, hey, by making this change, you're addressing, your users have expressed that they have a lack of, let's say, trust in your product. Well, by introducing this change, you're also addressing the psychological principle or component of control, that people need to have a feeling that they have control over their situation based on their decisions that they're going to make. And so I try to marry the two together. And often it is conversations with the client, and then also understanding the intent of the designer and working together with the designer to know how they intend to address some of the issues that exist with the product, and so that I can work with them to talk about why that should be effective or why the suggested change that they're going to introduce is likely to make a positive impact on the design.
As a UX researcher, as you call yourself, is your primary role consulting people and giving them advice and recommendations, or, you know, producing any kind of physical deliverables, as say wireframes or whatsoever?
Well, I would stray from saying that I don't give good advice, probably. I'm just kidding. It's mostly working with our clients and working on teams that contain designers and developers, front-end developers, to get information from users, to do things like assessments on what a current property is. To answer your question first, I don't create anything. I work with designers.
Too bad. Yes.
Yeah, I work with the design teams to create. Initially, it's usually concepts, and then if we're working on a long-term engagement, it's to build out those concepts with the actual confines of whatever technology that we're going to have to be using to support it. But then it's my job to make sure that we're getting feedback from users throughout the process, that I can speak on behalf of what we've learned and say, hey, are we actually addressing this in a way that's going to be meaningful and that's going to positively impact the usability of a product? And what's nice about being a consultant is that I can pull in experience across a really broad variety of fields. So I can say to a car manufacturer, oh, well, you're trying something that I've seen done in banking, and actually here's something that worked, and we can test that, and maybe it won't work in a different scenario. But oftentimes it's like, hey, these principles or these things that I've found with users go across industry type, especially when it comes to like product usability and what people expect out of workflows or forms or the experience.
When it comes to user research and collecting, you know, data from user interviews, let's say, what would be your top three tips on conducting user research, interviewing customers, potential customers whatsoever?
Well, don't just go out and interview your friends or your closest design colleagues. That would be my first one. Try to find something that's somewhat representative of the people you would look for. Then don't be afraid to let there be silence. Oftentimes people need some time to think, and I'm guilty of it as anyone else, but silence can feel a little overwhelming, or like you just want to say something to break the silence. But if you let people think, eventually, more often than not, they're going to say something, and it's going to be something that they've spent a little bit of time reflecting on at that point. And then the third thing I would say is just don't try to answer every question in the world with one interview script, and try to be focused around what you're asking. Start with a big question. So your big question could be, what do people need my product to do? But that's not what you will actually end up asking them. Really, you want to refine that into, okay, what are people's needs with whatever the specific topic your product is trying to address? What are they currently doing to meet these needs? What and where are there opportunities for you to improve that experience? And then answering those smaller questions can go back up to creating a larger an answer for the larger question of what does my product need to do or how does it need to work?
That's great advice, definitely. What's your favorite form of collecting, you know, user feedback? Is that live interviews over the phone or user testing or some forums service whatsoever?
My personal favorite method is to do what's called contextual inquiry, where you're out in the field with people observing them in sort of their natural habitat. Usually that's not what we get to do because of budget and time constraints. And so then interviewing is my next most likely thing that I'll do. And if there's a lot of interviews that need to be done in a short amount of time, they will often end up being done remotely because it's easier and less time consuming than traveling all over the place to talk to a dozen or more people. But I really do like to be in person because I feel like you can develop a rapport with somebody in a way that doesn't necessarily happen as easily on the phone. I tend to be, or at least people tell me that I'm dry and sarcastic, and I don't know if that comes across very well sometimes
not
over the
phone.
Not
so much today.
And so oftentimes I think that people will just take what I say for its face value, and they don't know that I have like a silly look on my face, and then it's like, oh, well, that just got awkward. But when I'm interviewing people, I do my best to let them be the ones speaking and keep my sarcastic, dry humor to myself as much as possible.
That makes sense. You come off as friendly today. Oh. Congratulations.
Why, thank you. I've been trying.
But you see, I can see your face. Our listeners can't.
That's true.
All right. Thank you for coming today, Victor. Where can people find you and your book online?
All right. Sure. All over the internet, I am Victor Yacho.
Sure.
So my Twitter handle is at Victor Yacho, and it's VicTorYocco. And my personal website is the same. It's www.VicTorYocco.com. And my email address is also VicTorYocco@gmail.com. And if you take the time to send me a personal message, I will definitely take the time to reply. If you get a chance to read the book or any of my articles, I would love to hear what your thoughts are and start a discussion from there. Also, Jane, I'd love to provide you with a discount code that you could put on the show notes for
your listeners.
Let's
do that, sure.
And that
you would like to... Mm-hmm. Would you like to announce that now? Or
sure. As long as I don't say it incorrectly, yes. So the discount code that listeners could use for 39% off if they order the book through my publisher, which is Manning, manning.com, M-A-N-N-I-N-G, is the letter S, the letter M, like man, and the letter A, and then my last name, Y-O-C-C-O. So it's all one word, S-M-A-Y-O-C-C-O. And there should be a field to enter that in at checkout for 39% off of the cover price of the book. It's also
for
sale.
Is that psychology? For 39%.
I'm thinking it is, actually. I didn't make that up, but I've had a few questions about that because that seems to be the standard discount that the publisher gives. And I'd like to ask them that same question, which is, you know, did you do some research that 38% doesn't seem like enough to people, but once you hit 39, they're like, sure, that sounds like a good discount, or if that's just something about their profit margins that works for them. But That's the deal that I can give out, and I would encourage people to use that over paying full price for the book, of course. Save yourself
sounds
some
like
money.
A great deal, yeah. Buy a few lattes, do some research.
That sounds like a good day.
Right. So thank you for joining us today. These psychological insights were definitely very helpful, and I hope everyone who is listening to us today is going to just go out and apply them
thank
in
you.
Designing software.